Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly update on all the hottest news and trends from the technology sector. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones, and this week we'll be looking at what happens when giant computer systems fail or are attacked by hackers. What can be learned from the collapse of an airline's computer system, and what's the criminal underworld saying about last month's global ransomware attack? We'll also discuss bullying in online video games and find out what the games industry is doing about it. Joining me to discuss all that is BBC technology reporter Zoe Kleinman. Hello, Zoe.
Hello, Rory.
Good to have you back. And my special guest is Mariam Jam, entrepreneur, founder of Africa Gathering, an amazing digital get-together. She's just joined the World Wide Web Foundation. Welcome, Mariam.
Thank you, Rory.
Very good to have you in the studio. Here's a flavour of what's coming up.
So I was playing a game, I must have been like 10, and I was winning, and suddenly I just had like abuse hurled at me. I was like, oh, this is a thing.
There was an informal meeting of elders of criminal underground, and the general consensus was they're not behind this attack.
All that soon. First, this week we had a graphic demonstration of how dependent the airline industry is on computer systems and what happens when they go wrong. When British Airways suffered a major IT failure at the weekend, 75,000 passengers had their travel plans thrown into chaos. Here's how some of them reacted.
It's just ridiculous that yeah, I know they're trying to accommodate us, but we had to call and book our own rebookings, even though I already had a confirmed seat. I had to rebook my own seat.
They could have done so much better. So, and I work in IT, and they're blaming this on IT problems. It's basic enterprise practice to have a disaster recovery solution.
And that's one of the big questions still to be answered. Computer systems do go wrong, but why did it take the airline 48 hours to put it right again? BA says it all started with a power surge at a data centre at London's Heathrow Airport, but it's given few details. Bert Craven of the IT consultancy T2RL has designed systems for major airlines. I asked him if he was any clearer about what went wrong.
I think the picture is emerging gradually, and I think it will continue to emerge over the weeks. What's becoming apparent, though, is that it does look like there was an element of human error. So, yes, there was a power surge, but it looks like it might have been a power surge caused by somebody accidentally powering down and then repowering an awful lot of equipment all at the same time.
From the outside, people will say, how could a mission-critical computer system with presumably redundancy built in, i.e. a mirror system at another data centre, how could that be brought down by effectively someone flicking a switch?
There's two different questions there. One is, in every data centre, you know, with the possible exception of ones that are completely dark, i.e. they have no direct human presence, there are always going to be emergency switches around the place, switches that are designed to protect the systems in the event of fire or something like that. And so somebody accidentally triggering one of those would have exactly this sort of effect.
But why, if there was a power failure in one data centre, did A, the backup power not kick in, and B, an alternative system in another data centre, which surely any responsible organisation would have.
Yeah.
Why did that not kick in?
I think that is actually the second and more important of the two questions, which is, you know, we accept that you can get large-scale failures in data centres, and that is why organisations operating mission-critical platforms will provide something called geo-redundancy. So this is a duplicate mirrored system in a data centre at a distance, and clearly either that was not the case or there was also a problem with the geo-redundant backup system at the same time, i.e. a perfect storm event.
You've worked for big airlines planning these kind of systems. What will they be saying when they look at this?
I'm guessing over the weekend, every CIO at pretty much every airline in the world was got out of bed by one or more board members and asked the question, could this happen to us? You know, where do we stand on our disaster recovery and our business continuity and so on? I think it serves, unfortunately, as a really useful reminder to the entire industry that we can't afford to take these things lightly.
We're more and more dependent on these huge computer systems. And so we're more aware that things go wrong and that they have a devastating effect on our lives. Some people might say, perhaps naively, can't we, in the final analysis, just go back to paper? Wouldn't it be easier?
Yes, and I think that until maybe 5 or 10 years ago, that was probably true, that at the end of the day, if the absolute worst came to worst, you could fall back to manual processes. However, the automation that large-scale computing has given us access to has meant that we can now run business processes at a level of density and volume that is extremely efficient, but for which there is absolutely no manual alternative. There were airports, and there probably still are some smaller airports today, where somebody will go in at 4 a.m. at the start of every business day and print off a whole load of vital information like passenger manifests and carry them around in their pocket. And if disaster strikes, they can revert to paper. But at a massive international hub, there simply is no manual or paper alternative to the huge systems we rely on now.
Bert Craven, and I rather think we'll be talking about other big computer systems failures in the months ahead. Now let's have a look at some of the week's other big tech stories with Zoe Kleinman. Zoe, tech leaders haven't exactly been shy about making their views felt after President Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement.
That's right. The tech giants, for once, appear to be all in agreement with each other, actually. They've all criticised the president's decision. The chief executives of Apple, Google, Microsoft and Facebook. Tesla boss Elon Musk said that he would be quitting two seats on the White House advisory groups that he's currently in. Microsoft, IBM and Amazon said they would continue to try to meet the goals of the agreement. Tim Cook said he'd tried to convince President Trump not to leave in a phone call earlier this week. And he also said the news wouldn't change Apple's commitment to protect the environment.
Those tech leaders don't seem to have had much influence so far. A very important satellite launch this week, which should make it even easier to surf the web when we're on a plane.
Yeah, I love this. The most powerful commercial broadband satellite ever has just gone into orbit. It's called Viasat 2. And while it's going to be providing broadband services to customers in North America, Central America, the Caribbean and parts of South America, it's also configured to service planes and ships. So it's looking to grab that sort of share of business of stuff that's crossing the Atlantic. I think that'd be brilliant, don't you?
There is increasingly few places where you can escape from the internet. They're talking about putting a mobile phone signal in the London Underground now. I'm addicted. Sometimes I'd like to get away from my addiction. And which country has banned the internet for being too much of a distraction?
Ethiopia blocked internet access in order to prevent national exam papers from leaking online. Well, that was the official story anyway. The country said that only social media sites had been blocked. But people in Ethiopia have been telling us here at the BBC that there's been widespread internet disruption affecting mobile networks as well as fixed line services. And on Thursday, the BBC couldn't access any websites belonging to either the government or its communications provider, which is called Ethio Telecom. Google also says traffic to its services from Ethiopia have dropped dramatically since this ban happened on Wednesday afternoon. That's one way to get you to concentrate on your revision, isn't it?
It is. My special guest is Mariam Jam. You are the first African woman on the World Wide Web Foundation. You got some perspective on this. That story there, do some African governments still too often think of the internet as their enemy?
Absolutely. I think that's a very good question. They do. I mean, and increasingly they are thinking the internet will be very bad for them. At the same time, I think there's a contrast. They would like people to have access to the web. At the same time, they want to censor the information that's coming out from the West. That's what they're thinking about. And I think now, but people are using WhatsApp. They're using WhatsApp quite a lot on their phones. Data is quite accessible now. But they definitely think that internet will be is their enemy for sure.
But there is a huge appetite for connectivity across Africa. It's coming at quite a speed. They're going to find it difficult to stem the demands of people to be connected.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I find it really ironic because, they want to give access to people. But at the same time, they're trying to censor that. They can't censor the internet. Everybody can have access to it now. But the other problem we have, I think we need to really discuss very quickly, is that, you have so many African people who would like to have access to internet, not just to, access to fake news, but they want access to Wikipedia pages. They want to learn offline, online. They want to have access to materials. And I think the digital inequality you're going to see in the next, 10, 15 years in Africa is that we have so many fiber optic coming to Africa. Internet will be fast, but people will be make money out of the internet. But at the same time, I think we need to start pushing for internet for good and really educate the government to understand that, Facebook is not internet. And I think they actually now, many of the government people actually don't know, what is the role of the internet. They just think the internet is actually Facebook.
And what are you actually going to do about it? You've been put on this World Wide Web Foundation. You've obviously got, that has a sort of global role in shaping the internet. But what do you want to see happen in Africa, and what would you be lobbying for?
I think I'm extremely honored to be the first, black woman to sit at the, board of the World Wide Foundation, working with Tim Berners-Lee, who's the inventor. And I think what I'm looking for really is to make people understand that, this gentleman invented the web for good, and we need to use the web for good, I think. But at the same time, educate the African government to understand what digital equality means. I think there will be the internet poverty in the next 10, 15 years in Africa, where, marginalized communities may not have access to internet, and they will just spend a lot of time on Facebook, not just intellectually learning something. And so I think that I'm very focused on women and girls. As you know, I just created I Am the Code to give access to women and girls to learn how to code, but at the same time have access to materials that, many people can have. So if I can really push the agenda for policymakers to understand that we can use the internet for good, but also, give access to people, I think that could be a really good thing.
A big mission for you. Good luck with that. You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service with Rory Catlin-Jones. In a moment, how did the criminal underworld react to last month's ransomware attack? Before that, we're all too familiar, sadly, with the problem of abuse and bullying in social networks. But this week, an anti-bullying charity called Ditch the Label published research showing the extent of the problem in online games. Its survey showed more than half of young gamers reporting that they'd been subjected to hate speech while playing online. 16-year-old Bailey Mitchell told me about his experiences.
So I was playing a game, I must have been like 10, and I was winning, and suddenly I just had like abuse hurled at me. I was like, oh, this is a thing. And pretty much from that, it's just sort of regular. Every other game you're in, there's always somebody that just calls you whatever random abusive thing they can think of.
How does that make you feel?
At first, it affected me quite a bit because I took it quite personally. But over time, eventually, I kind of grew and learned to cope with it. But when I was like 10 and I was getting these things, I was like, who are these people? Why are they being mean to me?
Do you think this is common, and does it matter, or is it just, part of playing a game?
It is just part of the game. It's not okay to hurl abuse at people, and you can't just go around calling people whatever you want in real life. Why is that not the same rule when you're playing online?
How bad can it get, though? Is it just a bit of fun, or does it get really serious?
I've received death threats quite a lot on regular occasions. If I'm playing a game and I score a goal, I've literally been told to kill myself.
And what impact did it have on you there?
So I developed quite bad anxiety, and I get stressed quite a lot in social situations. This time a year ago, I probably wouldn't have been able to sit down and talk to you now.
So what would you like to see change?
Well, I would like to see a complete overhaul in the reporting systems, particularly ones I've used on PS4. If you report somebody, 9 times out of 10, nothing's going to happen to them. And there needs to be actual people monitoring the reports and complaint systems rather than just having a bot do it. And I think also there needs to be people in games monitoring game chats and people's mics, that what they're saying. I think that needs to be monitored too.
Bailey Mitchell. Now, this research was carried out by the charity in collaboration with an online game called Habbo Hotel. The games industry says it does act to protect young people, but it seemed unconvinced by the methodology behind that research. Joe Twist is chief executive of Yuki, which represents UK games businesses.
My reservations were really about the sample of people that were questioned and how we define and make a difference between what happens in communication channels online more generally as a social issue and what might happen specifically within games. I mean, games companies are really responsible. players are our lifeblood, and we use all sorts of moderation techniques, semantic analysis, AI tools, human intervention, blocking, silencing, all sorts of tools to be able to make sure that players are having a safe experience and playing in an environment that's friendly to them. So I think my reservations are really about the sample of Habbo Hotel specific users, and trying to extrapolate that to a sort of general perception or representation of games and online games.
But it does highlight, does it not, that there is a problem there. I mean, the young man that we spoke to, 16 years old, he was getting bullied at school, was coming home and seeing games as an escape, and then finding he was bullied there. You've got to say that's a problem.
I think he has the tools to stop it. And, you know, unlike in face-to-face interactions, you can't just block or silence people. In online games, the beauty of them is that you can, and you can find out the information about how to manage your experience online and in games by going to the game publisher or developer's website. And the tools are there. You know, the blocking, the silencing, it's just like on Twitter, it's just like on Facebook. You can manage your own experience. And I think the more education about the tools that are available, you know, that young people can use, the better.
Some parents might think you sound a bit relaxed, a bit too relaxed. A lot of parents are quite ignorant about the online gaming world, about what experiences their children are facing, and would like to see perhaps a bit more protection.
I think the key thing is it's a shared responsibility, and we always encourage parents to take an interest just in any other activity that their children do, and they make sure that they themselves are going to the right resources online, like askaboutgames.com or NSPCC, for that safety advice. And also understanding the different kinds of games that are out there. There are games that are age-suitable for everybody, and some games are really only suitable for 18-plus audiences.
Joe Twist, Mariam Jam, you work with young people. Is this a big worry? Do they know how to cope?
They know how to code, but I think what is really crucial that we need to start teaching our young children what is digital identity and digital citizenship. And this is, we have a curriculum right now addressing these issues, and this is massive. We need to address that urgently.
Zoe Kleinman, as a parent, is this something you worry about? I know your children are probably too young to be gaming on their own, but they will be one day.
Yeah, I know. They are too young at the moment to get on the internet without me, so it's all quite easy for me to manage. I think what's interesting is, you know, you play a game like FIFA. It's a really fun but robust game. And even if you don't have the headset, there's this chat that goes on between, you know, as you can type chat as you're playing. And let's just say, they tend to be pretty robust, these chats. And, you know, whether you're winning or losing, you can certainly know about it, let's say. And, you know, the thing is, I guess, without that audio cue, you don't really know who it is that you're engaging with. You don't know whether you're sort of having a robust conversation with an adult or a child. And I think that is really difficult to manage.
It is. And we as parents have got to be better at it ourselves. Now, back to massive computer failures, this time one caused by criminals rather than human error. It's still not clear who was behind last month's WannaCry ransomware attack, which affected organisations around the world, including hospitals here in the UK. But what's the word from the criminal underworld? Andrei Barisevich is a cybersecurity researcher at the Recorded Future Threat Intelligence Company. He works as a consultant to the FBI and helps government organisations and businesses fight cybercrime. He's been monitoring the hacking underground, and I asked him whether they were impressed by the WannaCry attack.
Oh, no, not at all. From what we saw so far, the community of hackers and criminals were strongly against this attack for a variety of reasons. First of all, general consensus in the criminal underground is we should not use ransomware to attack hospitals, for example. We should not attack police departments. The reason is the repercussions for these attacks would be immense for them. They know that now they will be portrayed, no matter whether they did it or not, as an attacker behind this attack. We saw one of the members actually saying that there was an informal meeting of elders of criminal underground, and the general consensus was they're not behind this attack. Nobody who's been doing criminal, you know, endeavors and ransomware attacks before is behind WannaCry attack. The magnitude is absolutely stunning. The number of victims is absolutely unprecedented. How quickly this worm spread is also of super importance. And they saw that governments and law enforcement around the world now will be obliged, if I may say it, to really, really start pressing criminal underground and hackers.
So you're saying there's a sort of code of honor amongst the international community of hackers. And they'll be angry.
For the most part, they are angry, they are not happy with the results of these attacks, and they are definitely not happy that law enforcement around the world think that they are behind this attack.
Well, we've also seen this group, the Shadow Brokers, who leaked online those hacking tools stolen from the National Security Agency, thought to have been instrumental in this attack. We've seen them basically propose a new business model where they're prepared to rent them out per month for a fee.
That's... I haven't seen this... this proposal before, in a way that, you know, no criminals before attempted this business model. I'm very puzzled by the latest move they make. It's total surprise to me.
But we've already seen that at least one of those tools can be devastating in its impact. Will that be the concern now, that there are more of these tools that could be out there, could be in the hands of criminals and could cause much more damage?
Absolutely. Even criminals, for the most part, criminals didn't even believe in how powerful these tools are. For example, Eternal Blue and Double Pulsar, when it was released a month ago or so, for the most part, criminals said, well, yeah, not a big deal. I mean, we've seen these kind of tools before, nothing new here. And then we saw, you know, the attack of the magnitude of WannaCry attack. So now criminals clearly will pay closer attention to the usefulness of these tools and how they can actually utilize it to attack victims around the world.
That's Andrei Barisevich on that scary prospect of further attacks, possibly. Before we go, my special guest, Mariam Jam, has been sitting opposite me very patiently while I'm wearing something rather ridiculous. Just describe to the listeners what you can see.
Oh, my God. I think it's really cool, actually. You're wearing a glass, really funky, greeny, with some camera. I think this is good for hackers as well to use.
What I'm actually wearing is Snapchat's spectacles, which have just arrived in Europe. I've been trying them out. I spent some months wearing Google Glass until I tired of people being rude about how daft I looked. Mariam, you've been very kind. If you go to our Facebook and Twitter accounts, you'll see just how daft I look wearing these glasses. We've run out of time. Thanks to my special guest, Mariam Jam of the World Wide Web Foundation.
Thanks
to my BBC colleague, Zoe Kleiman. You can read all of our stories at bbc.com/technology, including seeing me in those glasses. Remember our BBC Technology Facebook page. And don't forget to join us again in the Tech Tent at the same time next week. Before you go, if you're enjoying Tech Tent, then allow me to recommend another offering from the BBC World Service. Just one question first. Do you eat? Well, if you answered yes, then this podcast is for you. The food chain is for farmers, foodies and fellow diners. Go to bbc.com/foodchain to find out more.